Next case is Amgen v. Apotex, 2017-1010. Mr. Groombridge.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. I would like to begin by talking about the 1 gram per liter limitation, and specifically Amgen's view, the principle enunciated in this Court's decision in the Sanovian case should lead to a finding of infringement as a matter of law. And what Sanovian says that if the FDA application document, in that case an ANDA, but here of course an ABLA, speaks to the relevant parameter recited in the claims, and if from the FDA application document it is clear that the applicant is seeking approval to do something that is covered by the claim, even if it may also embrace subject matter not covered by the claim, then that is nonetheless an infringement as a matter of law. And that is what we think is clearly established by the ABLA documents here.
Well, you argue that in the ABLA documents they show that there could be some variation. But there's nothing that indicates that the variation could be of any particular measure. Are you saying just because there's some possibility out there that they could read on the claims that we're supposed to assume as a matter of law that they do?
No, Your Honor, that's not what we're saying. And I think that issue was addressed in this Court's decision in one of the Fearing cases. But that's precisely not what we're saying. And I think I would respectfully disagree with the way Your Honor characterized our view of the ABLA. That what we think is the ABLA specifies an amount of inclusion bodies, 0.9 to 1.4 grams per liter. We know that that is not a wet weight because when the ABLA wants to talk about a wet weight, it does. For example, in the appendix at Appendix 5588, where it specifically refers to the weight of the inclusion bodies after the washing step and when they've been centrifuged, characterizes that as a wet weight. When it talks about forming the refolding mixture, it does not characterize that amount as a wet weight, and indeed it gives only one specification, which we find in the appendix at 5595, and it says the only requirement that is specified is a purity of greater than or equal to 75%. And I think the district court found that purity means is that of the protein present, at least 75% of it has to be filgrastim. So, Your Honor, in our view, what Apotex is seeking FDA approval for here is a process in which it is allowed to refold inclusion bodies at a concentration of 0.9 to 1.4 grams per liter. And the only requirement that is imposed on those inclusion bodies is that they consist of at least 75% filgrastim, the protein in them. And if we do the arithmetic there, that means they are seeking approval to conduct a refolding process at a concentration that includes, and in fact it exceeds, 1 gram per liter. They are also seeking approval for a range that goes below that, but under the holding of this court in Sanovian, that doesn't matter. And in our view, Your Honor, where the analysis went wrong in the district court in part is that it focuses on a different requirement, on the requirement that is characterized as a key process parameter.
You're putting an awful lot of emphasis on your Sanovian argument.
At the beginning, Your Honor, yes. There's another point I would like to get to that is unrelated to Sanovian. But the key process parameter, which specifies a certain amount of protein, is by its very terms something that is able to be departed from. And in fact, that is why when we look at the specifications in the ABLA, there is no acceptance criterion. There is a dash in the column acceptance criterion for that parameter because Apotex is allowed to depart from that. And indeed, this is addressed explicitly in the ABLA, and the citation is in the appendix, is 67, 24 to 25, that explains the significance of those terms and says if it's a key process parameter, that is non-critical. That means that you can depart from it. and it may affect things like yield, but it doesn't affect product quality, and therefore you're not constrained by that. And so what we have here very clearly, in our view, Your Honor, just looking at the ABLA, is there is a situation in which they are seeking approval to do something that falls within the scope of the claims.
But don't the ABLAs themselves indicate that the key process parameters have to be carefully maintained within a very strict range?
I would say not, Your Honor. I would say the only thing that was that is cited by Apotex and was not referenced by the district court, it's in the table, it's the note, if you will, in the table that appears in the district court's finding of fact 19. I don't believe it's mentioned anywhere. There is a note that says something to the effect of this is the qualified range based on the experiments that we are conducted. That doesn't say that you can't go outside that range. It merely says these are the experiments that we've conducted to date. And when we look at the definitions of key process parameter is one of two things that are designated as non-critical. I think this appears at 6725 in the record.
Part of the problem here is what burden you have. Mm-hmm. I mean, that it's your burden to prove infringement. It's not their burden to disprove it. So you're saying that just because there's somewhere some possibility that they could infringe, that we're supposed to assume they do infringe. And yet everything, the ABLAs themselves have a calculation that's 0.708. I recognize that not all the batch records were produced, but those few that were produced did show a range even much lower than that with respect to the protein calculation. So why haven't you failed to prove infringement?
Your Honor, we've come back to look at this under the controlling law. What we look at is what are they seeking approval to do? What are they asking FDA to allow them to do? What they're asking FDA to allow them to do is to refold protein at concentrations that certainly exceed 1 gram per liter. And the calculations based on that key process parameter are non-limiting. And if they were given approval, I think the measure is this, that they could operate inside that 0.9 to 1.4 range, which is specified. It's not a situation where the ABLA is silent, and be above 1 gram per liter in the refolding mixture. That's what they're asking the FDA to allow them to do.
I think you're probably going to have to go over ground that you've just gone over to answer this, but... tell me what's wrong with the following. Either the ABLA addresses this matter, in which case there's enough evidence to conclude that what you can infer from the ABLA is, 0.708 grams per liter, or it just leaves it open and doesn't constrain it or authorize it, in which case the two batch evidence seems to indicate a number even lower, around 0.56 or something. Either way, you have not proved satisfaction of the greater than 1 gram per liter. So what's wrong with, and the two either ors are, maybe one can summarize them as Synovian and Glaxo.
Our view is that this is a Synovian case, not a Glaxo case, Your Honor, and that the ABLA does address this. And indeed, first of all, that the ABLA makes clear that when it's talking about a wet weight, it says a wet weight. Right? And that thus the weight that we're talking about in the range 0.9 to 1.4 is not a wet weight. It's not so specified. And indeed, when it says that the amount of inclusion bodies should be, quote, equivalent to 0.9 to 1.4, what it's saying is that's not a wet weight. And if we look at the immediately preceding part of that, where it does spell out a wet weight, it gives a different range of numbers, 2.8 to 4. Right? And so in our view, Your Honor, what we've got is a situation where the ABLA absolutely addresses this issue. It allows Apotex, if it be approved, to operate within a range.
So the term allow is a bit of an uncertain term. Right. It can mean an absence of constraint, or it can mean an affirmative authorization?
I use it to mean an affirmative authorization, Your Honor. In other words, I don't use it to mean a situation where the ABLA is silent and therefore it's not prohibited. I use it to mean a situation in which the Food and Drug Administration has said, you can operate within this range and you and that is explicitly approved by us. And that range, on any fair reading of the ABLA, includes 1 gram per liter in the refolding mixture. Now that's what we think the ABLA discloses.
And you get, so on the assumption that the ABLA affirmatively authorizes, what specifically do you say overcomes their evidence that when you do the minimum 75% protein and whatever that the inclusion body process parameter of 4 to 11, you end up with the 0.708?
Your Honor, they're not constrained by those numbers. In other words, if I'm working from memory, but the numbers that are approximately 4.2 to 11.8
right.
are not limiting. In other words, those are not a specification. And when we look at that part of the ABLA, it has a column headed acceptance criterion, which means this is something that you have to meet. And if it's a requirement, there's a value in there. So, for example, the immediate line above, in purity, it says greater than or equal to 75%.
Do you happen to have the page cite in the
I think
you said it, but I don't remember.
It's 5595 in the appendix.
Thanks.
Can I turn to your other argument with respect to the buffer strength should be unlimited?
Yes, Your Honor.
If we conclude that the patent doesn't limit buffer strength and there is just absolutely no outside limit and it is unlimited, why doesn't that render the patent indefinite?
Your Honor, because I think there are numerous examples of patents in which they specify there's a lower limit but no upper limit. And what the patent teaches us, if we look at the bottom of column 8 and the text that carries over to the top of column 9, it says, here's a technical reason why if the redox buffer strength is too low, things will go badly. The reaction will be uncontrolled. Conspicuous by its absence from the patent is any comparable text that says, if we go too high, here are bad things that will happen.
Well, there is a lot of text that talks about capping it at 100, correct?
The same text is about effectively bounded at 100 is repeated 5 or 6 times,
at least,
I think.
At least 5 times.
Right. Yes, Your Honor, at least 5 times. Okay. Right. But in our view, there's no indefiniteness here because this is a situation, and I don't think indefiniteness was argued on this. This is a situation in which a skilled person can clearly understand this. And indeed, the upper limit, as the district court found, is that effectively bounded language reflects solubility concerns. So a skilled person would know how much in any given
system. Whatever the reason, that was the interpretation of the district court.
That's correct, Your Honor, but as a factual matter, right? And I don't think there was any disagreement. In other words, I think the testimony at trial was unanimous that the reason for that limit had to do with solubility.
And Apotex is well clear of that.
Apotex is well clear of the 100.
Yes.
In our view here, when we read this patent, this is a classic example of there's a broad introductory statement at the bottom of column 2 in the summary of the invention. It says when it introduces this idea, it says 2 millimolar or greater. And then it goes on to talk about various embodiments, and that's where the language effectively bounded at 100 appears. And it's hard for, I would submit, to imagine how someone could write a claim, what language they would use to try to express that the claim does not impose an upper limit, apart from saying something like 2 millimolar or greater. It has a plain meaning, and all we ask is that it be given that plain meaning. If I may, with my remaining time, I did want to touch on, to go back to the 1 gram per liter and just touch on the BPCIA issue, in which, as the court I'm sure is aware, what happened in this case was the ABLA was disclosed, the BPCIA exchanges did take place, Apotex did provide a detailed factual and legal statement regarding the reasons why it
did. You ever ask for a request for admission to pin them down to that?
We did not ask a request for admission. We certainly did ask their expert, for example, in discovery, Your Honor, and in discovery, she said she confirmed the statement that was made in the 3B submission. And it was, in fact, not until trial that she then repudiated that testimony and said that she had misspoken.
What is your position with respect to the weight? I mean, you originally said these should be binding, these patent dance disclosures, and then you backed off in your reply brief and said, well, they should at least have some probative weight.
Your Honor, we have never said they should be binding, and our position is this, that the Supreme Court and every court that has ever looked at this has made clear that these exchanges are part of a very carefully calibrated scheme to prepare to litigate. And our position is that, as we said in the reply brief, that they should be treated as something analogous to, for example, contentions in the local patent rules of courts that have those things. If you make an honest mistake or something happens that couldn't have been predicted and you want to change it, of course no one would say, too bad, you made a mistake, you're stuck. That's not justice. But in our view, there should be some mechanism like seeking a good cause requirement to say, look, we want to depart from this, and there's a good reason to do it.
So in the absence of that kind of request, then you would argue that it should be binding?
What I would say, Your Honor, is I am reluctant to make a statement categorically across all fact situations that it should be binding. What I would say is that it cannot simply be discarded as inconvenient when a litigant wishes to now take
a
contrary
position. Well, if it was weighed and given probative value, like an admission by a party opponent, couldn't it still be outweighed by the fact that the record discloses that it was just not correct?
Conceivably, yes, Your Honor, although we would submit not under the circumstances of this case, where there were ample opportunities to correct it, and it was not until trial and without explanation that we were told that it was all wrong.
Mr. Groombridge, why don't we hear from the other side, and we'll give you your 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Golub.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. With respect to the 1 gram per liter and the Synovion.
Wait, can I start at the back end first?
Sure.
So you never did move to amend your letters, did you?
We never did move to amend our letters, but in answer to your question, they did ask requests for admissions. We denied it. They asked interrogatories. We denied it. We also filed summary judgment on the issue. They knew exactly where it was.
Is it your position that these patent dance letters that everybody says are very important to this entire process should get zero weight?
Well, I don't think the court gave them zero weight. The court clearly considered them in his findings. He said he considered them, but they were not as probative as the other evidence.
Well, didn't he actually say they get no probative weight? That's a little bit different.
Well, it's unclear. He had to have considered them, because to say they didn't get weight, he had to have considered them. He clearly considered them, and he said that the other stuff was much more important. There was extensive evidence to the contrary.
But it was really trial by ambush. I mean, even when your expert purported to testify on this topic, the judge sustained an objection to that testimony on the grounds that this whole issue of the water content was not at issue.
It wasn't a trial by ambush. They took Dr. Dowd's deposition, the fact witness. He told them what was in the inclusion bodies. He told them about the water. Like I said, they asked interrogatories. They asked requests for admissions. The patent itself talks about, in two places, washed inclusion bodies that are frozen. That means they have water in them. All we did was have an exact calculation at trial as to how much water. But when you look at the trial testimony of Dr. Wilson, he admitted that he knew that there was water in there and that he just didn't take it into account. That was one of the four very important factors why the court found that they didn't meet their burden. This is not a situation where it's our burden to prove anything. It's their burden to prove infringement.
I've got a problem with the fact that the trial court relied on testimony that he sustained an objection to. That's improper, right?
Well, what happened is on cross-examination, the door was opened by Mr. Groombridge and his team, and so we were allowed on redirect to put that evidence in.
What about the fact that the 89 batch records were not disclosed?
Well, I think we
again, how can a trial court rely on documents that were never provided during discovery?
I believe he relied on the two batch records that were in the ABLA to come up with confirmation that the number was less than the 0.708, and I think he just relied on the others that there were a lot of them done.
But so, we should assume that we can't rely on those because they were never part of the record, right?
Well, I think that the testimony was part of the record, and the judge took the testimony of the witness and said there was no clear there's not clear error for him considering the credibility and the testimony of the witness. All of this evidence, a lot of this evidence that Mr. Groombridge is discussing, was actually elicited by his team. The water issue on cross-examination with Dr. Wilson came from their own expert who said, I knew about the water and I was a bit worried about it. They knew about the water. And again, what they're doing, the only...
But wouldn't have known what the water content was. And Dr. Dowd's testimony, he admitted he had no firsthand knowledge.
Well, they knew what the water was because they could have figured it out just like he figured it out in the math that he did on APPX 4790. He walked through the entire process with them.
What does your ABLA mean when it says key process parameters have to be narrowly controlled, but you concede that they can be varied? So is there any limitation on how far they can be varied?
Well, the question was asked of Dr. Dowd at trial what the KPP means, and his answer was, quote, effectively, that's a specification upon which we need to maintain the process within for the batch to be acceptable. And he further said that they would throw it out if it was beyond there.
So what do you make of page 5595? This is the dash under the acceptance criterion column.
Well, I think that I make the same thing Your Honor said earlier. If there is no upper limit, then there's also no lower limit, and there's no specification at all. So then we would be outside of Sanovian and into Glaxo. And under Glaxo, the court found, without any clear error, that the batch records reflected that the protein concentration was nowhere near 1 gram per liter. So, but Mr. Groombridge just said in his earlier argument that it wasn't a specification. So therefore, if it isn't a specification according to them, then we are in Glaxo world where the court specifically found that the protein concentration doesn't meet the 1 gram per liter.
So maybe I'll ask the question this way, and I might be mischaracterizing Mr. Groombridge, but one version of my understanding of what he says is when it says under the acceptance criterion dash, that is a form of saying anything along these lines is just hunky-dory with us. So that's a Sanovian case. We affirmatively authorize you to do anything you want in this, for this row, this item, and anything you feel like doing is certainly going to include more than 1 gram per liter.
No, that's not. The only testimony that was elicited on the issue was they couldn't exceed it or they would have to throw it out. The dash itself is speculation from Mr. Groombridge. There's no testimony on what the dash
means. About what the dash means in this document.
And again, if it means that you can go past it, it means you can go anywhere, either way, so then it's not a spec. But the court found that you couldn't do that, and that it was a spec, and that we did not infringe. Again, it's their burden.
And you agree then that it means that you're not authorized to engage in any conduct that could infringe?
Correct. The only evidence out there was if it did exceed that, we would have to throw it out because it would be beyond the spec. That's the only evidence that's in the record. If you are allowed to exceed it, then it is not a spec and you go to Glaxo. And the court found that we don't infringe under Glaxo. Again, this is a burden issue, and the court put out in paragraph 32 four different reasons why Amgen did not meet its burden. Most importantly, its own witness, Dr. Wilson, who said he didn't account for the water. And again, inclusion bodies is not the right place to look for protein. The reason why Amgen went there is because when you look at the actual spec for protein, the maximum is 0.708. That doesn't help them. Even with this claim construction, which we assert is not correct, but doesn't matter if you go with our non-infringement position, because it should be 2 grams per liter and not one, but that's the only thing they argued. Inclusion bodies equal protein. And the court looked at that and said they did not meet their burden on there because they didn't account for the water. All of the evidence from Dr. Dowd and Dr. Robinson, they cross-examined them. They elicited the information themselves. Mr. Groombridge asked Dr. Dowd something like, so you're saying it's two-thirds water. That went unrebutted. All of the evidence with respect to the water went unrebutted. They never put Dr. Wilson back up to say, no, that's not an accurate calculation. No, this isn't true. All of the evidence went unrebutted, and the judge found, based on that evidence, they didn't meet their burden, and there's no clear error here on that issue.
Why does the amount of water matter? It's really just the question of how much protein there is, right?
Yes, but because they were using inclusion bodies as their basis to show protein, we had to show that it wasn't all protein because that was their argument, that inclusion bodies were effectively pure protein, and therefore it met that claim limitation.
Are they two-thirds water?
They are two-thirds water.
Can I switch topics and just ask you about the other issue?
The 2 millimolar?
Yes, the 100 millimolar
sure.
Piece of the construction. Where does that come from?
Well, it comes from the fact that, as the court pointed out, there are five places that discuss the issue of the 2 millimolar. In every single place, they say it's effectively bounded at 100. In addition, all of the examples show nothing more than 20. There is no disclosure of anything more than 100.
But each of those places refer to a preferred embodiment.
It's the only thing disclosed. It's not the preferred embodiment.
Well, there have been many cases where there was an alternative not disclosed, and we haven't limited the claims in that way.
Right, but in this case, because every time they talk about it, it is effectively limited by that 100. Therefore, the court found that was an express definition. And that's consistent with SciMed, where it's the only thing disclosed and it is particularized to that one claim term when you're looking at the spec. It is not the preferred embodiment. They had 20, they had 14, they had different examples with different numbers. But every time they talked about it within the spec, they basically defined it as being
bound. But the claim doesn't have the 100 cap, does it?
No, it doesn't.
All it says is 2 or greater, right?
It says 2 or greater. So under Phillips, you look to the specification, and you see if there's anything that limits the claim terms. And the court said it's defined because it's effectively limited at 100 every time it's talked about. It's not a preferred embodiment. It is a definition.
Do I understand the relationship among these basically two issues in this case, that if you prevail on the 1 gram per liter, the other issue does not matter?
Correct, Your Honor. Absolutely. We only need to not infringe one limitation. So that is absolutely correct. I'll address, I think we've addressed the letters. Again, I think that the real issue here, can we talk about waiver for a moment? The claim construction issues, the judicial estoppel, and the waiver. I couldn't tell from Mr. Groombridge's argument. I'm hearing that he believes the letters are binding. I think we cited to 104E rule of evidence, which says that a factual finding must be able to be looked at in terms of weight and credibility in view of other stuff, and therefore could not be binding.
Well, he thinks they're binding in the absence of a motion to amend and a showing of good cause, which you didn't do, and you had plenty of opportunities to do that, didn't you? I mean, to show up at trial with a whole new theory that is inconsistent with your patent dance letter seems kind of completely inconsistent with the purpose of the act is.
We didn't show up with a whole new theory. We told them all along that we didn't infringe because we didn't meet this limitation and that inclusion bodies contained other stuff besides protein. That was our answer to every discovery issue, and they took his deposition. Dr. Dowd specifically said that they contain water in his deposition. They were on notice of that. It wasn't a surprise to them. The court found that it wasn't a surprise to them. He said they should have known about it. There's a finding of fact where he says that they should have known about the water. I believe it's 38 or something like that. They weren't surprised at all. And in fact, when we get to the issue of the waiver, at the closing argument, Mr. Groombridge said, quote, "I would like to be clear. We are not suggesting that the letters are in some way binding."
Well, what,
that's a waiver.
If we're to basically say those letters can be treated as meaningless, aren't we acting in a way that's completely inconsistent with the purposes of the congressional purposes behind the act?
It's no different than the notice letters in Hatch-Waxman. And I don't think that the court said that they were meaningless. He viewed them in view of the other evidence and weighed it and said the other evidence was more probative than that. Again, in the Hatch-Waxman context, the letters are mandatory, and you're allowed to change your positions. So how can these letters, which are not mandatory, this dance is optional, as the Supreme Court said in the Amgen v. Sandoz case. So if these letters are optional, how can you be stuck with this way early on before discovery, before anything happens, when they knew very well what we were arguing? And in fact, the letter is incorrect and doesn't even say what they say it says. It says that there's a concentration of filgrastim. That's the protein of interest. They're saying it's inclusion bodies. So they're not even making the same argument. If this court was to say that those letters are binding admissions, it would chill the entire process. Everybody would look at this and say, there's no way I'm going to do this optional situation and be bound by this before I take discovery, before I have claim construction, before anything like that happens. Under Takeda, as I said, they're mandatory letters and you're allowed to change your position. The situation should be no different
but
here.
But even under Takeda, you have to ask to change your position, correct?
No, you don't. It depends on what court you're in. If you're in Texas, where they have mandatory disclosures, or in New Jersey, that's true. In this court, you don't have mandatory disclosures. We answered their interrogatories. We answered their request to admit. They asked us if the inclusion bodies met the protein limitation, and we denied that. We filed summary judgment that we don't meet it from the inclusion bodies. They knew exactly what we were doing.
Mr. Golub, your red light is on. You haven't taken note of that, but I'll give you a couple more minutes since we've given Mr. Groombridge more time. Take 2 minutes if you need it.
Your Honor, I don't need it. I think I just need to say that the court made specific findings that the Amgen did not prove infringement for specific factors, and the weight of the evidence should not be overturned. There is no clear error here. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mr. Golub. Mr. Groombridge has 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to my friend's assertions that they did disclose this theory, we disagree, but I would point the court to this by way of example, which is it's page 9605 in the appendix. It's the deposition of their expert, Dr. Robinson, about 1 year after the 3B letter and about 3 months before the trial.
I'm sorry, but regardless of any of that, you do not have an argument here that this was improperly admitted, that is the new theory, because it wasn't disclosed in an expert report. I didn't see anything
that's correct,
like that. So you do your only argument is they said something in the patent dance letters, turns out to be false, they say. We have evidence that it's false. The district judge said it's false. I'm going to go with the truth. What's the problem? Unless you're making an argument, which I think you're not quite making, that what they said in the patent dance letters is actually legally binding and they're stuck with it even though it's false.
We're certainly not saying it's legally binding and they're stuck with it though it's false. What we're saying, Your Honor, is that they should not, under the circumstances of this case, have been allowed simply to repudiate it, and the district court should not have given it no weight, which is how we read the decision, particularly when it goes to this key contested issue, and it represents their reading of their own BLA document, which
but
is...
What's your response to your friend on the other side saying that they actually responded to your interrogatory requests and denied that your reading of their ABLAs is accurate?
We disagree, and I'm not sure what my friend is talking about. I would say that, to my knowledge, and certainly what's in the record before this court, there is no such assertion. The summary judgment papers, the summary judgment motion to which he alluded, was based on a different theory of non-infringement, that the minimum protein concentration had to be just the protein of interest, here for Grasdim, not all protein. And that certainly was framed. It was the subject of summary judgment motion on which we prevailed, right? It's not the theory that they then unveiled at trial and on which the district court decided it. And I would just read, here's a question and answer from this deposition. Question, what's in those inclusion bodies that's not a protein of some form? Answer, there can be membranes, cell membranes, lipids. No mention of water. There was not one point to our knowledge, and certainly in the record here, where somebody said, oh, these things are two-thirds water. And that was the fundamental problem. And Judge Toronto, just to make one final point, to talk about this, the Glaxo versus Sunovion issue. In our view, the proper reading of the BLA is the 0.9 to 1.4.
So let me just ask you very specifically. Did you have evidence about the meaning of the dash in that column on 5595?
I believe there is no evidence, there's no testimony that says what that dash means.
Isn't that, I mean, I guess it feels to me like that's what your case on that rests on, and yet you don't have evidence. You're asking us to say this dash means we, the FDA, recognize that there is this process parameter, we hereby affirmatively authorize you to do anything you want on that process parameter, but I'm hearing it just from you, not from evidence.
No, well, Your Honor, I would direct the court to page 6725, where talking about the key process parameter, it says, if the acceptable range is exceeded, it may affect the process, e.g. yield duration, but not product quality. That says you can exceed it.
Thank you, Mr. Groombridge. We will take the case under advisement.
Thank you, Your Honor.